I'm Norma Everest from Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, and this week we've been considering a series of titles which might altogether be categorized as Christians living in the public world. And we started on Monday. Some of you have been with us all week and others have come and gone, talking about American civil religion. On Tuesday we talked about responses to civil religion. Wednesday evening we considered symbol of crisis, the public school. And today we want to think about a company of strangers in a pluralistic world. We'll refer to some of those concepts that we've built on during the week, but we'll really go into totally new area today as well. So if you weren't here those other days, it really won't be that difficult or that consequential. For 10 years, we lived in New England, and part of the history of New England is the town meeting. And the rest of the country gets to hear about that when the New Hampshire primaries come around, and the news cameras all focus in on the town meeting hall. And indeed, it is still used. However, some of it may be perfunctory, or just going through the motions. But indeed, there is a very real history of people in a village coming together for a town meeting. I think the best example of that that I've experienced in latter years is the open classroom method of education, in which, if any of you participate in that, the children come together once a day for a classroom meeting and determine how they're going to spend their time apart from one another. But perhaps for me, the most lively concept of people coming together in a public place took place when we lived in Detroit before our time in New England, and were involved in block club organization. There, people came together because they had to, because it was a matter of life and death. We lived in Detroit during the riots, and after the riots, our block was on fire one day, and the fire engines came, and it was the most frustrating thing to have all the fire engines there and the fires roaring, but the hoses wouldn't work because the pumps were worn out from the riots. And the block was really in danger of burning down, including our white frame church, which was right there. Well, fire was a very real danger, as it is here. As we come up the hill and stop before we're let out of the bus and told what to do about our common enemy, which is fire. Well, after that time, we determined that we needed to get together because the people on that block didn't know one another. In fact, one of the most difficult things during the riot was that we could not support each other because we didn't know each other. So we determined to go and meet the neighbors and to organize a block club. And some of you have probably been engaged in block club work throughout your own years of ministry. Just knowing one another, knowing the names and faces of one another, was terribly important. So we came out of our private worlds, often our private fear-filled worlds, and came together as a people who lived in that neighborhood. Now, if I were to say we're going to talk about neighborhood today, with such an obvious topic, we all live in neighborhoods. But I'm not so sure that we all do live in neighborhoods. We live somewhere, on a block somewhere. But many of us do not know or have much in common with the other people that live in the area. In fact, in suburban areas of which I've been a part, one really can't walk to one's neighbor's house. One has to go in a car. There aren't sidewalks in some suburban areas. And instead of the porches in front, there are patios in back, which are much more private. And really, we exist very much side by side in privatized little worlds. I take very seriously the ministry of creating neighborhood, or if you will, of creating community. I think we are getting very close to living in an armed society and in a time of scarcity, not only being afraid of one another, but grabbing and storing and hoarding what I have so that I have enough, whether or not my neighbor does, I think will be a very true reality. A I sometimes would fantasize, and it wasn't all that, didn't take that much of a fantasy, to think what it would be living in Detroit or in New Haven, to walk outside and really to literally be afraid any time of the day or night that our neighbors would shoot one another. As I say, it didn't take much of a fantasy, because at night one cannot do that in most areas of our country. In fact, now that we've lived in Dubuque for 5 years, a year or so ago, I walked to our church, which is about 6 blocks away, and I walked at night and I thought, for 20 years, I have not walked alone as a woman at night anywhere. And it was a strange, wonderful feeling, tinged just a bit with a little fear. And most of you are familiar with organizations and a movement, Take Back the Night, which is to make communities safe for women, and if they're safe for women, also safe for men. So the very fact that not only are we privatized, not only do we live in fear, but we also arm ourselves against one another, says to me that our privatized existence just won't do. It is not a healthy thing to live that way. On Monday, we talked about American civil religion, and we left some of the papers sort of on the board. We had to tack them back up here again. And they're written in all sorts of handwritings because we did that together. But at least something I'd like to point out, and that is creeds. These are various components of American civil religion. Robert Bella has made the point that beside and separate from the established religions in this country is an American civil religion, with its sacred writings, sacred places, sacred events, holy days, symbols, rituals, priests, prophets, martyrs, creeds, and you can see some of them up there. But just for now, I'd like to catch some of the creeds, because I think that's an important place for us to contrast American civil religion with Christianity. We will progress, we are right, bootstrap philosophy, consume, buy, this land is our land. We are generous people, but also we're a private people. Family, take care of my family first. And if we were to add some more there, I think our first one was be number one. Important creed of American civil religion is be number one. Well, if American civil religion is a faith which permeates our society and therefore has shaped and formed me because I've grown up in this country, someplace deep in my bones, I believe be number one is important. And that has shaped and formed me, so I'm going to watch out for myself first. Well, knowing the nature of humankind from Christian teachings, I also know that each of us, as sinful human beings, is going to take care of number one first also. So that's not too hard to believe. But there's another tenet of American civil religion. We didn't put it up there, but it's a free country, isn't it? You heard that one? It's a free country, isn't it? Meaning, I can do anything I want to do. Well, it's hard to live together in a public world with that creed. I can do anything I want to do, can't I? Last night in the play, the Irishman singing and the other ones, you know, the noise factor was an example of that. Indeed, there's also a creed that the strong will survive. Work your way up and the strong will survive. Not a concept of body of Christ or of diversity of gifts or that every person is needed, which I think is very New Testament. I'm told that here at Holden Village we have a emphasis on people power rather than on devices that economize people labor. People labor is important here, and I think that's the way we're created to operate in the world. But certainly our civil society does not operate that way. People become obsolete. And when we live in a public world in which people are and are afraid of becoming obsolete and unnecessary to one another, merely burdens that get in each other's way, we do not do very well in creating a public world which honors everyone. I don't, however, think it is merely a nice Christian idea to work toward community. I think it is absolutely necessary for our survival, absolutely essential for the strength of our country, And the concept of living together in a public way, in a public world, means that it's absolutely essential for the sake of the survival of the world. We must learn neighborhood. So a ministry of creating neighborhood in a global community is, I think, a calling, a vocational calling for all Christians. American Civil Religion has as one of its tenets that this is a chosen people created and given the best government on earth to free the whole world, in other words, to make the whole world in our image. And if some of you were here Monday, we quoted a speech from Senator Beveridge at the turn of the century. God has not been shaping this people for 1,000 years for nothing but to serve as the savior of the world. That kind of flavor that somehow will manifest destiny, that our task is to not only be number one, but to be number one for the sake of the world. You see, that sounds so benevolent, doesn't it? Sounds so benevolent. A quote from a book that I find very useful, Parker Palmer's A Company of Strangers, and it is in the bookstore. W.H. Auden says, in a parody of him, in effect, "We are all in the world, if we are all in the world to save all the other people, what are all the other people in the world for?" Now think about that for a minute. A public outlook among Christians asks them to care for the good ordinary people who are not saved and may never be. It means having concern for arts and letters, the quality of life, its cultural dimension. Well, there's an interesting dimension to our messianic complex, and also to concept of what is mission. Yeah. Okay, I believe that we fear the poor. Not only do we not want to be like the poor in our neighborhood or in our neighborhood of the world, but we actually fear them. A couple of years ago, when we had the boat people from Cuba, and of course for a number of years we had boat people from Southeast Asia, it was not only that we did not want them on our shores, we were afraid of great numbers. Remember some of the rhetoric? What if they all come into our community? What if all of them show up here? You know, not just one, but they're taking over our neighborhood. That kind of fear we have never been free of, even though we have the Statue of Liberty there, give me, you're tired, you're poor. We live with that ambiguity of what it means to come here, what it means to be a people, who are part of the people, and who are outsiders. We live with the fear of the poor, and I think other people in the world are absolutely amazed that we seem so rich, so secure, so free, and we fear them so much that we fear that we really have to either bomb them or get rid of them. It's really very strange. It will not do, however, for us to pretend we are poor, to merely do a flip side. Even on a day like yesterday when we thought Francis, St. Francis, what a marvelous model. For us to pretend we are poor, to, in a kind of pseudo-copying of St. Francis, take on the look of that, we played with that a little bit yesterday, would not really do. For one thing, the world wouldn't believe us, would it? Even in our community in the inner city, for us to pretend we were poor, when the poor people there knew we weren't. They thought our house was the library, contrasting their houses, we were a library. Nor for us to burn our books or throw them away, to share them, to uphold, to learn from the neighbors, and I learned so much from the people on those blocks in Detroit and New Haven, to learn from them, to figure out a way for us to live in mutuality and interdependence. Maybe this will have to translate in your own mind to a time in which you have been paternalized. For a black knows what it feels like for a white to say, oh, I know how you feel, or to try to act black. A woman knows when she's being paternalized. Laity know when clergy say, the work of the church really belongs to the laity, and then nicely keep control of it for themselves. So whatever it takes to translate that into your own lives, it is not just playing with being on the other side, but learning from, growing from, lifting up gifts, believing that we are created to be a people of the earth, and believing as Christians in the body of Christ that we will be able to live out of it and live that we're all strong. Not so that I play weak, so that we're all strong. And to not be afraid of my neighbor being all my neighbor can be. To not be afraid of that neighbor's strength. I think that's a marvelous calling. Well, a couple of words I'd like to put up here. One is public, the other is private. And another is pluralistic. Very interesting word, the word public. To be a public people is knowing that there are strangers out there with whom my lot is cast. There are people out there, and we're in this world together. A couple of quotes from Parker Palmer. In ancient Greece, the public life was the only life worth living. In public, free men dealt with matters of moment and mutual concern, shaping their common destiny. For the Greeks, a young man's entry into public life was a critical life passage. Indeed, the word public finds its root in the same word which gives rise to puberty. Both suggest the movement into adulthood. For some of you that were here last week when we talked about education in adulthood, there are some echoes of that. Well, you'll note, however, that we use the word man, and Parker Palmer doesn't use it generically. For the Greeks, it was for the man to be a public man. And listen to how we use that word today. What's the connotation of a public man? Someone who's in office, someone who's in the business world. And what's the connotation of a public woman? Often meaning a prostitute. A public man and a public woman have very different connotations in our society. When we think of private, okay, it's quite all right for a woman to be private. In fact, for women and children to be in the private sector, often in suburbia. Well, the man goes out into the public world and returns to the private sphere to be nurtured, to be sent out again into the public world. That raises some questions we'll get to a little bit later and then also tomorrow. And then where is the church? Is the church in the private sector? Or is the church in the public world? I think, and we will spend more time on this tomorrow, for those of us who are Lutheran, thinking about a new Lutheran church, it must mean that we're at a time to be in the public world. In other words, what in the world are we doing? Okay. Interesting concept of public and private. Parker Palmer, however, is not denying the private world. In fact, he says, I argue that the renewal of private life is one of the reasons for working on the recovery of the public sphere. We need the private life in order to be public, in order to have strength to live in the public world. Just as here, we each go to our own rooms and then come together. And we go apart and we come together. Both are necessary. That rhythm of private and public is a necessary one. The concept, however, of private, I'd like to share a bit of this. Most of us seek to live and work in the most private spaces possible, spaces where the public cannot intrude. We sleep, arise, and eat in the privacy of our own home, the ideal being a single-family dwelling set far apart from the neighbors. We drive to our job in the privacy of an automobile. We park in an underground garage and then go to work in a space where only colleagues are allowed, then back to the auto and back to the house with little or no chance for interaction with strangers. If circumstances force us to take public transportation or walk the public streets, we often find ourselves in situations so crowded, noisy, and tense that we ignore one another. And the headphones business, is an interesting symbol to me of our Sometimes I wonder if you're going to run into a bus when you're on your skateboard and that, you know, thing. But but an interesting symbol of the private sphere. We try to carry that private sphere into the public world. And certainly we are a nation that will not give up our private automobiles. All sorts of things have been tried for shared rides and so on. And rugged individualism, American civil religion creed, huh? It is my right to protect my house with my gun and to have my private world, which is my automobile. Okay. In our free time, when we might mingle with the public in a park or at a sporting event, we are more inclined to watch the game on TV in the privacy of our own living room. Okay, we can maybe think of, when we talk in a few minutes, about ways in which that privatized world, I think, is just carried almost to an extreme. It's interesting to me, the other day, Wednesday night, we were talking about the public schools, and one of the crises is whether or not our country should go more to a voucher system, more to private schools. That's a question that is very much there. Okay. Parker wonders that too. At bottom, religion, like the public life, has to do with unity, with the overcoming of brokenness and fragmentation, with the reconciliation of that which has been estranged. Public life creates the community which both establishes legitimate government and holds it accountable to what the people want. One quote about the schools. A public school is a place from which no child is barred, a place where the common culture of a people can be passed along from one generation to the next. So he is using the term public as a way in which we as diverse people live together. And I think we have to move into the sense of the word pluralism to really force the meaning of that. Public does not mean a place where people who are much like each other come together. We are a pluralistic, a diverse people. And it is a scary, marvelous, wonderful, strange thing to come together as strangers in a public world. To come together and pretend that we are all alike is to delude ourselves, and we will be scared and run right back home again because my neighbor does not look like myself. Quote from Thomas Mann. Okay. I think in order for us to get a handle on what it means to be Christians in the public world, we have to come to grips with our own xenophobia, our own fear of the stranger. And in order to come to a concept of the meaning of hospitality, we have to first of all face the concept of fear of the stranger. Hospitality in our culture often means inviting people to our house whom we already know and like. And not really a sense of being hospitable to strangers. But if you think of the few times in Scripture in which the word hospitality is used, it is used in the sense of being hospitable to strangers, okay, to the outsider. And when Palmer talks about reconciliation of the estranged, reconciliation, bringing together of those who are strange to one another, and to those who have been estranged, those who are the outsider to the insider. Again, in your own mind, you can think of the time in which you have been the outsider. Maybe it was not being invited to a birthday party. Or maybe it was when you were kind of walking outside and everybody looked like they're inside having a good time. Whatever it was, you recapture that feeling of being the outsider. And the lack of self-worth that often accompanies that. Each day, when we meet in the public world, we take a risk of not being accepted. So much easier to be with the people we already like. And actually a risk of being in danger from others who are afraid and from the ways we hurt one another when we fear one another. But to think that God is only a God of people who like one another is to domesticate God and to relegate God to the private world, to have him at or her at our table and no one else's table. A couple more quotes, and then let's move right into some discussion. Palmer says that when we meet together in the public world, strangers are able to meet on common ground. And we need to raise the question, where are those pieces of common ground? Are there any? Are there places for us to meet in the public world? Again, not public meaning government, public meaning people. Where fear of the stranger is faced and dealt with. And when Wednesday night we talked about the public school as a symbol of crisis, I think a lot of things get dumped on the public school because the rest of society hasn't dealt with these very issues. Where scarce resources are shared and abundance is generated, rather than when scarce resources are hoarded from one another. Where conflicts occur and are resolved. And it doesn't mean that if we get together as a block club, there aren't going to be conflicts. More conflicts will come. And maybe we're too tired to go out of our house at night, you see, and to meet the public. There will be conflicts, but where they're resolved. Where life is given color, texture, drama, a festive air. Where people are drawn out of themselves. Where mutual responsibility becomes evident and mutual aid possible. In Detroit, when we had the riots, we were not able to help each other because we didn't know each other's name. After we organized and had a communication between us, an old newspaper, we knew one another's name. And when our kids, you see our kids around here, they're little, and we'd go in the strollers and deliver our little block club newspaper to the neighbors. And even though not everyone came to a meeting, we knew that they read that. And then when we had later riots erupting and so on, and murders and whatever, they knew each other's name, and it made a difference. There was a sense that they were known and that they knew one another. Where vision is projected and projects are attempted, and we tore down a lot of garages that were fire traps. We got together and saw what needed to be done, and we did it. Where people are empowered and protected against power. When we got together in New Haven, we scared redevelopment out of their boots. Now, they always won because they had more power than we did, but when the people got together and had power, they were able to empower each other. There's a book out just a few years ago called The Suing of America. The way often we meet in public places in the courts, the rise in the number of civil suits is just phenomenal. What do? You sue one another. The Suing of America, it's an interesting concept. Okay. One other quote, and I think that this is helpful. To not deny the stranger, to not deny our fear of the stranger, but rather to take that, what a curious inversion, taking feelings of estrangement, which we normally try to get rid of, and calling them positive signs of vocation. Perhaps our vocation, and this goes back to last week, some of you were here, Luther talks about vocation is all that we do in relationship to our neighbor. And for Luther, vocation is always rooted in the forgiveness of sin. The forgiveness of sins brings freedom to relate to the neighbor. Okay? So perhaps these very feelings of being stranger is the call to vocation. The call to be Christian people in the public world. Okay, let's stop there so we have lots of time to think about these things. Any of this relate to where you are in your head or where you live back home? Because you all live in neighborhoods too, and we probably have every kind of neighborhood represented in this room. So I'd like to know how some of these concepts relate or don't relate to you as a Christian in the public world, to you in your neighborhood.
A lot of organizations you belong to? I mean, every night a meeting you could go to in your town?
Tired to death. We're organized to death. I'm not too sure. We've created public spaces to be together. We have the meeting of the knitters and the meeting of the drawers and the meeting of the trustees and the meeting of the... I get tired thinking about it. No telephones up here, but as soon as you get home, somebody's going to call you about a meeting that's next Tuesday, right? Yeah.
The any of you live in St. Louis? We lived there in the early 60s, and there's Igel Pruitt's housing development that was just new when we went there. And within less than 15 years, maybe even a decade, those were blown up, I mean, bulldozed down, new housing developments. They had not worked. They were to put lots of people, you know, straight up and down in housing development. And one of the things that we have learned since that time is that people need defensible space. Now again, that's a kind of militaristic term. I might use different terms, but you need space that you call your own. And when you put people, you know, with no, they can't step out their door without being in, quote, no man's land, no person's land, that it becomes, it's not safe. I mean, those housing developments were not safe.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's that dogs and stuff. They
define their territory. You mark it off. You know how. Okay, so it's an interesting kind of concept. And how, if in a sense I cannot stand to live in the public world, you know, how can we?
There has been some beginnings of overcoming of that in Los Angeles out of fear. And skyrocketing crime rate. They develop neighborhood watch programs to use the police staff because the police don't have enough manpower to, and that has, at least you know, when the neighbors on your left and right, or if you live in a single family dwelling, you know, the people live in a block or two radius, the neighbors.
I think to some extent, the patio in the backyard is a myth because you really never use it. If you do have a time when you're home and different members of the family go different places and stuff, and
fragmentation
really
of family.
More public than we admit. It's something to complain about rather than the reality.
So fragmentation of the private life. We work out to build the patio, but once it's built, we don't have time to sit on it.
Just trim the lawn around.
Trim the lawn. Okay. Fragmentation of the private life, which is not really quite satisfying nor really public in this sense.
Hmm. That's interesting. We watched the migration in New York from when the Verrazano Bridge was built between Staten Island, which is a borough, and connected it with Brooklyn. There was a mass migration of Italian and Jewish and some blacks and all into that island of originally 150,000 people, tripled within a few years. And they built all of these suburban-type houses with a little backyard, which they didn't have in Brooklyn. And then in front, they have these little, just little, tiny little steps, you know? And the phenomenon was that they never used their backyard. If you drive in Staten Island to this day, you will see all the people sitting still on those little front steps, not in the back.
For 10 years of my life, I say I had a porch sitting ministry. I got awful tired doing porch sitting ministry too, because you don't just sit, but when you're out meeting people and you find there's things that need to be done and you do them together, there is a real connection between small town life and inner city life in that kind of sense. We had a home for the aged across the street, a Jewish home for the aged, and when some of their children, the second generation, wanted to have them have a nice home for the aged out in the country a bit, they didn't want to go. They want to stay in the city where they could sit out in the front sidewalk and watch life going on. Well, we got a lot of different pieces here. I know, let's see how they go together. Go ahead, Doris.
Well, I thought might be interesting, maybe you haven't thought about this, but particularly the supermarket. If I go into a mall and shop, you know, people will talk to you because there's dances and people shop together, but the supermarket, have you ever thought about the supermarket as a good time? Not a soul talks to you, and we're all walking up and down the aisles and we pass one another, and I'm often thought, really, what if I just stopped and said, well, what are you?
Okay. What would someone do?
Someone would probably say that only. So what happened is, I do my shopping normally in about 45 minutes, you know, just send them out and get it all over. I mean, it's just a huge shopping market packed with people, and not a soul speaks to a soul. And so I took our granddaughter shopping. And I put her, we didn't take care of her, and I put her in the shopping cart. And as we went down, she went, hi. And so we started a conversation. The baby opened the door.
Yes.
And I talked to this one person, and we stood, and we talked. And then I talked to something else. So we talked about pretty, it was not just the baby we talked about. We got into other things, and we continued down the aisle. She said, hi. Opened another door. And I couldn't see how many doors. We couldn't spend.
Marvelous.
And so we went up and down the aisle and did today 2 hours.
Marvelous.
And the baby was so tired. I had to go home. But it was my own.
She's tired opening all those doors. I'm writing that down. By the way, I believe in teaching that we learn the most from one another, and so I'm taking notes on what you say because I want to learn from you. Often in discussion or after a lecture, people put down their pencils, you know, because that's just when you should take them up, because that's when you start learning from each other. Parker Palmer has considered that, and he says, where is the public space today? So the closest thing to it is a shopping mall, which is not public, it is private. It is privately owned, and it can be very closely guarded, and if there gets to be, quote, trouble, wrong kind of people, whatever, you can't be here, please. Someone the other day was saying, want to have a peace demonstration in the mall. Well, the mall didn't want you to have a peace demonstration there. So that public space is private. I did a videotape a couple of years ago trying to look for the public place, and we went in Dubuque. It is JF Kennedy Mall on Sunday afternoon. There's a little fountain in the middle of the mall, and that's kind of the town square. People sit there, and maybe they talk a little more than in L.A., for example, but not a great deal more. But children can open doors. I told you about taking my kids in the strollers organizing block clubs. It was safer for both of us, safer for me not to leave them home alone, but also safer for me to go with the kids. But they opened a lot of doors, too. And interesting, a little child to lead them in a new way. But opening doors to people, there have been studies done of, you have farmers market in your town? Or, you know, this kind of a thing, how much more conversation goes on at a farmer's market than a supermarket, which is energy efficient, supposedly, time efficient.
We live in the Twin Cities supermarket called Minnesota, and there is a new kind of supermarket there called Cub, owned by one corporation, but there must be 15 or 20 of them now. They're very large, and they have, you can mark your own, but the machine does the prices and you get the tape back, and it sounds very mechanistic. But the fruits and vegetables are like the farmer's market. They're all out, and people do talk to each other while they pick up the grapes, whatever, and it's a whole big end of the store, and in that part of the store, people talk to each other.
In contrast, when people are about the supermarket, recently there was on the media put out an article about that. That's the place where the young men meet the girls.
Oh, that's where, yeah, on Saturday. It's all kind of ritualized. Mm-hmm. You have to know what time to go there, right?
Right, and also what time in the evening you have to work. There are certain stores that are better than others.
You know which one? Okay. No, Saturdays where all the high school kids go to the mall, or whatever it is in your town. Yeah, there is a ritual. Again, a public ritual. Go ahead.
I think one of the reasons why the private sector or the private view has come up so strong is because many times it's a place that we can hide and don't have to share who we are as an individual, as a person. Sometimes also in the crowd that can happen as well.
And I think sometimes a role that, the community, the neighborhood group can offer, or the church can offer, is a place where people can be open and share themselves. But it costs something to have a relationship, even out there in the public sector. It costs that you might have to get involved with someone. And I think sometimes we fear that because we're not really willing to either share ourselves, open ourselves, or to create that kind of relationship and responsibility that goes with that relationship.
Yeah, and that's, we've got a number of pieces out here that are kind of unresolved, and that's fine because we won't resolve them all. But there is a need for private. Look at how many 300-400 people in this village. There is no way in the time we have to get to know everyone. We go home kind of with the idea that we've been in the presence of a lot of gems that we didn't really have a chance to look at fully because every hour and the hour almost are coming and going. LA is kind of like that. It is just how much energy, time and energy does one have? Palmer also talks about the spiritual life. In fact, he talks about Thomas Merton here, and some of us have been seeing or talking about Thomas Merton these last 2 days, and says, Merton, who, I had the quote a while ago, Merton who entered the monastery at age 28 in full flight from the world, in Louisville, Kentucky, where the monk had made a rare trip out of the cloister to see a physician, in Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could no longer be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. And another quote from Henry Nouwen. The paradox of hospitality is that it wants to create an emptiness, not a fearful emptiness, but a friendly emptiness, where strangers can enter and discover themselves as created free, free to sing their own songs, speak their own languages, dance their own dances, free also to leave and follow their own vocation. Hospitality is not a subtle invitation to adopt the lifestyle of the host, but the gift of a chance for the guest to find his own. So how, the other day when we talked about reactions too, and we used Niebuhr, and we came up with Christ and culture and paradox, certainly there's a paradox here, to the private and to the public, and to how much of oneself, and the going apart.
The gathered people of God, I'm going to let it in there. Gathered people of God become the scattered people of God. The rhythm for that.
The needing to be alone in order to have strength to come together. Is Bonhoeffer's Life Together. The person who seeks solitude, beware of solitude if you're afraid of community, and beware of community if you're afraid of solitude. That kind of concept, that's very loosely quoted. But the rhythm of that, and hospitality, a ministry of hospitality, means not that the host will eat you up, that somehow there is a space, and that the private, so that I can be full. In fact, the life of spirituality is not just going into my own self world, but going deep enough into self to find God, to find strength to come back out again. Okay, let's jump in.
I just wanted to speak to that in relationship. I have strong feelings about the relationship to children. Even with children, they're organized to death.
Yes.
And I have nothing against part of that going out into the public, because they need to do that too. But they are so organized that they have no private in order to renew them for the public. So the organizations aren't moving. When I'm discussing or talking to the kids, I find that the organizations aren't really public. That they are in their soccer, but they're not really communicating in their soccer or in their dance class, that they all come together. They all come together little private people. And so I ask them, when like, I give a personal experience when I was a child. I had the time to fix certain things, you know, and I was, I cherished that time when I just sit on the back porch and just daydream and these things. And I asked them, did they ever just sit down and just look out the window and daydream? And they don't. And that's private.
I sometimes wonder if our organization, our super over-organized society, isn't both an escape and a pseudo-longing for community that is not really very satisfying. We're organized to death. We're meeting to death. And it is not really simply coming together. In fact, we often stratify ourselves even more. One of the marvelous things for our children growing up in the inner city is if they didn't go to this kind of lesson and this kind of club, just went out in the street and played. And I kind of cherish that for them. I don't want to romanticize it either. But I think our busyness is often a symbol of our lack of spiritual fullness. And somehow some of that's tied together. Okay, we're just kind of getting more pieces here. Let's keep at it.
I'm talking about the new church. You need to be a couple of places. I was thinking of my own church. We're also in the city. And we have a food bank at our church, which is not a public food bank. There are public food banks, too, but it is for those people who somehow can't make it to the food bank. And one Sunday morning, two women with two children came at, you know, a most inconvenient time, right? And Sunday school started and said that they really needed food because their children had not had anything to eat for a couple of days. The only thing they had left in our food bank was pancakes and macaroni and cheese. I mean, that's a strange combination. But anyway, the children were so hungry that the lady opened the can of pancakes right there and started feeding these children pancakes. Those children can't eat. So we thought, you know, we can't just let these people starve. I mean, if they haven't had anything for a couple of days, so we took them one of our nearer church neighbors, it's a little further out the suburbs, we went and had our daughter drive them out there and ask if they had anything left in their food bank. And the man who was the usher, and I'm not judging him because I probably would have discussed him and myself, he said to my daughter, you don't expect me to interrupt somebody's work. But she said, well, I guess that sort of is what I'm asking.
Yeah.
You know? And then the crew, you made them wait till community started making it, and that's where the picture came out. And I'm just thinking, I don't know, the paradox of that.
It's there.
Called the church of public in that you're going to be inconvenienced by the time or the place or anything else. I don't know, I have trouble with that.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is that in our community, we have a downtown feeding program fed by a Catholic church called the Safety House, where they feed the street people. And they end up with about 150 people off the street every day. And it's an interesting thing to see, as much as I know, and I don't know all about it, there are probably many people who support this, but the people who go down there and work and actually serve the people are most often for themselves, to share with their poorer brothers and sisters.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me a bit. There is, sometimes we just sit back and look at our own lives, we see the ridiculous. And that's where we meet each other, to kind of point that out, to just stop a minute and look, what are we doing? Not that worship is not an important thing, but feeding, you know, that they're somehow both are necessary. The necessity, and I think, isn't it marvelous how God creates us? Isn't it marvelous how God gifts us as different weaknesses and strengths to meet each other? And we work so hard at denying that. And isn't it marvelous how God creates this new into the body of Christ, not just one melting pot, one big blob, but keeping, I mean, if I were going to redeem and sanctify somebody, I should make them over much better, you know. But no, God just sort of keeps us, you know, as we are. And reconciles the estranged and puts us back together so that together we are empowered to be strong to serve. And that kind of paradox, so that we're not melded into one big blob body of Christ. We are individual, well, the scene to the summit, one Lord, many members. And doesn't deny that gives us the space. See, Christ took time away, huh? Gives us the space then to come together. And I think then gives us community, Christian community, to nurture one another, then to scatter into the world, and then to come back together. All of us, the little child nurturing us and back and forth, which is quite different from the private sector, which is what sort of, again, the older sense of women and children are to, well, woman is to nurture the man to go out and be the hunter, you know, to defend one's faith against the hard, cold world, that kind of model. I don't think we need that model anymore. But that we're called to nurture one another, to go out and to come back. And that both are really very, very important. Another thought you may have. Another reality. Every hospitable act is an outward and visible sign of our inward and invisible unity, a unity which finds expression in the very root of the word hospitality. For hospes means both host and guest. The two are really one. And I think of the hospice movement lately, which is in a different connection on the medical world, to provide space for dying and room, and to welcome that. Hospitable. The ministry of hospitality is a profound one. We, again, have domesticated it, but it's a profound one. And it means not too quickly taking away the stranger. As congregations, we sometimes want to smother. Someone comes in and we want to make them like us very quickly. To take away the strangerliness. But the power of God and the freedom of forgiveness, the freedom from fear, comes from that, means we're able to allow the other to be other. And to know that, not to rob that person of his faith either, but to be able to believe that we are one, and then to act on that belief in hospitable ways. I had an exercise that maybe I was too scared to do it. Maybe that's where we don't have time to do it. No, I've done this with people. Let me tell you about it at least, and you might want to try it sometime. It is in which we would have two people up here dialoguing, carrying on a conversation, not unlike you would under the bell over there, people that don't know each other, and to have a what I call a three-part conversation. It's really fascinating. Every time I've done this, it has worked out this way. It's just fascinating. In which the two people talk first, and I tell them to talk in a mode of just talking like, where are you from, you know, all that kind of thing. But talk in a mode in which you're somewhat suspicious of the stranger in the other, with a slight diffidence, with a slight disdain. Oh, you're from Chicago? You know, a slight fear, and to listen how that conversation goes. And inevitably, the fear builds, and you know, with a kind of hostility that you didn't even have to begin with. Okay. The second mode, then, they carry on the conversation. In the second mode, they carry it on looking just for the similarity. Oh, you're from Chicago? Yeah, my aunt was from Chicago. My aunt's name was Sue? Yeah, I had an aunt named Sue. No, this kind of thing. Very boring. Very boring. Very quickly. Only, it's sort of like cocktail conversation or narthex conversation sometimes. Okay. Looking only open to what is like the other. And the third mode is to acknowledge the difference and to go into the difference. And inevitably, without fear and without that, you know, putting off, and inevitably I've heard people come out on the other side with a richer sense of unity because they were unafraid of letting stranger be stranger. I think that's what God calls us to be about. And not only calls us, creates us and recreates us and empowers us and holds us when we are afraid, so that we can really be hospitable to strangers in a public world. How that works itself out is not easy. But I think it is a
terribly important marble carving.